Get ready for a couple hours of paranormal talk with Joe Nickel. A couple of his works include Adventures in Paranormal Investigation, The Science of Ghosts, and, of course, lots more to talk with about. We're going to talk with him about miracles, the Shroud of Turin, ghosts, Bigfoot, other monsters. We've got it all next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Joe Nickel with us, of course. Joe has been called the modern Sherlock Holmes, the real-life Scully, X-Files. He has spent four decades as an investigator of paranormal, forensic mysteries, historical myths, and hoaxes, in addition to the contrast of mystery mongers on one hand and so-called debunkers on the other. Joe believes that mysteries should actually be investigated with a view towards solving them. And I like that attitude, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. How are you, my friend Joseph? Good to have you.
Hey, George. Good to be with you. Of course, at my age, it's good to be with anyone, but it's especially good to be with you.
We've got some great things to talk about. Let's start with miracles. You wrote an article for the Skeptical Inquirer, Michael Shermer's magazine, about
not Michael Shermer's. We're the competition. We're the original Skeptical Inquirer.
Isn't that his magazine?
No, his is Skeptic.
Really?
If you're going to make a mistake, that's the one.
That's the one to make.
Well, Michael's a great skeptic.
We have always called him the publisher of the Skeptical Inquirer. Always. That's amazing.
Well,
I think it's
we're the Skeptical Inquirer, and we were around a long time before he came.
Could there be two of them?
No. His magazine's called Skeptic.
Okay, I'm going to have people check into that. But anyways, you wrote something for the Skeptical Inquirer.
Right.
Called what, The Flying Friar? What is that?
Well, there was a guy in the 17th century known as Joseph of Cupertino in Italy, and he was eventually canonized a saint because he could fly. Well, or so eyewitnesses said, as part of the saint-making process, you know, the guy dies and people want to make him into a saint, and so people are brought in to give testimonials of what they saw and what they knew, and he had made something of a sensational career of being able to levitate and fly. Well, I decided long ago that he probably couldn't do that. I didn't do an in-depth study because the materials are kind of hard to get a hold of, but the BBC pressed me, and I did look into it some years ago for a documentary. But now there's a new book out, and they've gone back to the old records and it's more accessible, and they're claiming that, well, he could fly, he could levitate. You know, my first response when I hear something like that is, well, the first, in a word, is law of gravity, and secondly, is why doesn't anybody do that today? Well, it turns out Michael Jordan does. What he was probably doing, if you go back and read the descriptions carefully, he would bound in a great bound. He once ended up in top of an olive tree, but they're not that tall, and you know, you could make a great leap, and he may have made leaps in increments, but what I found was that when you really looked at the cases, he was not sort of floating slowly in the air where people could describe that, and then maybe floating around a statue up in, you know, up high or something like that. It was totally just he makes this great bound up onto the altar and then maybe another bound on up. And these were straight shots as far as anyone can tell, just a straight forward leap. I'm sure they were amazing. I'm not suggesting that he didn't do anything or he wasn't a remarkably agile person, sort of a gymnast, but that he wasn't flying. And some of the stories will say that he embraced a statue way up there, Well, read the whole account, and you're pretty sure when you get through he was just holding on to the statue. He wasn't just embracing it. He was holding on for dear life because he could not float at all. And anyway, I did an article on this, and I'm waiting for, you know, the results to see how many people write angry letters to me. But now I see, George, thank you. You've directed all that mail over to Michael Shermer.
That's right. Maybe that's good, huh?
Yeah, that's good. Michael will thank me for this for forever. Actually, of course, he's a colleague and we're friends.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
That's right. We're all in the skeptical business, you know.
You're looking for answers.
I am. I'm not trying, as you said. I don't want to be a debunker, which I think is the flip side of the true believer. And the problem with both of those positions, because they're so much alike, you know, you have your mind made up in advance, pro or con, and don't confuse me with the facts. No, I want the facts, and I want to try to, this is messy, but I want to try to sort them out, prioritize facts, see if I can find the best ones, and develop a hypothesis out of that, and try to, the single word I want to end up with is explain. I want to try to explain something, and I'm confident that if I can explain something to you, and of course, if you believe me when I've made that effort, if you believe my explanation, you think, okay, that sounds pretty good. Then any needed debunking will have taken care of itself. I don't have to have had that attitude that I'm going to set out to debunk, which is prejudicial and indicative of bias and just not what we want in an impartial judger of fact.
Well, given the obvious, though, Joe, would you say that of any event that may occur, paranormal or otherwise, that the logical explanation is probably something natural?
You've hit on it, and I'm sorry our show's over with now, so early.
Thank you, Joe. Goodbye.
Yeah. No, you've hit on it exactly, George. First, we look for the natural explanation before we go into, if I may say so, la-la land or, you know, some exotic supernatural realm where we have monsters that are unheard of or sort of fantasy-type explanations for extraterrestrial behavior or something. No, we look for that which is explainable by nature. I personally have come to believe increasingly that we live in a real natural world. So when I'm confronted by something like the Flying Friar or a monster, my first thought is, well, wait a minute, have we exhausted sort of the things around us? Maybe we saw a real creature, a natural creature, only we just saw it under odd circumstances, or we didn't get a really good look at it, or something like that. And I'm constantly trying to explain monsters, for example, by first looking at the real creatures on Earth.
Let's talk a little bit about a few more miracles, and we'll get into the Shroud of Turin, ghosts, Bigfoot, and other possible monsters. Fatima in Portugal, 1917. What do you think happened? The explanation is three young children saw what could be the Blessed Virgin Mary. They brought with them and took some secrets that she apparently had told them. And the biggest possibility and the strangest thing, these witnesses claim that they saw the sun come down from the sky. That I've had my doubts with.
Well, can that many people, I mean, a really huge crowd finally for the final, there were some previous gatherings and then this just massive crowd, and people saw something. they did.
Something happened.
Something happened for sure. Those kids, the oldest little girl was actually, we can now say when we look at her, she was an unusual child. She was really precocious. She was talented as a imaginative child. Her older sisters used to prop her up during festivals, sit her up on a pedestal or something, and she would regale crowds by telling them stories. She was really quite a charismatic child, Lucia de Jesus dos Santos. And Lucia is the one who saw the Virgin. The other two children had to be sort of coaxed and shown, well, if you look there in the tree, you can. And eventually they thought they could see her. And then only Lucia really heard the Virgin tell these special messages that she was giving. We today would recognize her as what's called fantasy prone. I deal with that all the time in my work with a paranormal. A fantasy prone person is, first of all, someone who's perfectly normal. They're not, psychotic or something. They're within the normal range, but they're way over at one end of that spectrum where they're highly able to fantasize, rich imaginations. Whitley Strieber is clearly a fantasy-prone personality, and he had all these alien experiences. He's a wonderful science fiction writer. So these are qualities in which the person, that which they imagine seems very real to them. But again, they're not psychotic. They're not out of touch with reality. They're just highly imaginative. And they show up in the world of psychics and visionaries and people who see invisible things that you and I can't see. And Lucia was one of those. I mean, she really has those traits. You can kind of go down the checklist of traits and see that she was one of those. So when she goes out at Fatima and draws up a crowd, she regales them, of course, and eventually on the final big day when so many people were there and it had been raining and finally the clouds were sort of clearing and then she looked up and she said dramatically something like, "Look, look, the sun." And people stared and
believed it.
Yeah, and something happened. Some said the sun was spinning. Some said that it danced in the sky. Some that it came toward them and back. I've tried to explain that by looking at the behavior of the people and looking for retinal effects and effects of the eye. You can't stare at something as bright as the sun. You can try, but you'll sort of look and your eyes will retreat and you'll back away. And you could get movement from image and after image effect or even retinal distortion if you were to really stare at the sun. Let me just make a couple more points. Because this is so important, it's huge in Catholicism, and again, yes, something happened. People saw something, and we know for a fact that the sun didn't do anything. How do we know that? Because the same sun was over Fatima that was over Paris and everywhere else. So the sun just simply did not dance around or pulsate or come toward people. It did not.
Everyone would have seen it all around the planet.
Absolutely. I mean, we just have to make that point, no matter what a party pooper it makes me, but that's just a scientific fact. So they were seeing something, But they weren't all seeing the same thing because their descriptions, you see, are quite different. So you have people standing together describing the sun pretty much simultaneously, doing different things. And one more point, there have been other incidents like that at other places. For example, other gatherings to see the Virgin Mary, like at Lubbock, Texas, some years ago, and other places where there have been gatherings. And the same thing has happened, the same kind of massive, a lot of people reporting something that's loosely called a sun miracle, so much so that at one site, Mother Cabrini Shrine in Colorado, people were actually have been warned not to stare at the sun because people have actually suffered retinal damage.
We had a guest on, Joe, about a month ago, L.A. Marzulli, who comes on quite often, and he is convinced that what people may have seen that day in Fatima was a unidentified flying object that was in front of the sun and came down. What do you think of that?
Well, that's I would say, out in La La Land, it's not the simplest explanation, because every time we have one of these places, like at Mother Cabrini Shrine or in Lubbock, Texas, or we have other gatherings, so there have now been several of these, and the effects are so similar, we would have to have this flying saucer, you know, getting set and getting right in place and doing this time and time and time again. The simplest explanation, and that's what I look for, it's the principle of Occam's razor in science that says when you have more than one hypothesis, a good rule of thumb, a good way to sort out those is to prefer the one that has the fewest assumptions. So sometimes it's described as the simplest explanation, but, you know, you can say, well, the simplest explanation is a flying saucer. You know, well, no, the simplest explanation would be in the natural world, first of all. You don't have to assume that flying saucers are doing something and assume that they're all getting in place and working in concert or something. No, just that people have the same basic eyes, and if you stare at the sun, you'll get some effects. And if you were to damage your retinas, you would have some bad effects.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
Match some of what people saw. People were seeing colors, different things. Some of this might be sort of rainbow effects from the fact I mentioned it had rained. One more possibility that I've come up with and theorized about is if you had the clouds beginning to clear and you had, if the cloud layers weren't perfectly the same everywhere across the sky, you might have an effect as the clouds drift that they were blocking the sun a little more for a few moments and then a little less because of the thickness of the cloud layers, if I'm making that make sense.
I get it.
It's a little abstract, but if you could darken and lighten the sun that way, you might give the effect that it's coming towards you and receding, or you know, some effect like that. Also, clouds can you can be fooled as to whether the clouds are moving or the sun is moving.
Hold on, Joe. We're at the break. We're going to come back and talk more about you as the skeptic, but you're looking for answers. And welcome back. We're back with Joe Nickel, the skeptic, of course. Joe, let's talk about a few other possible miracles or not, and then get into the Shroud of Turin and ghosts, and then we'll take calls next hour with you. In Lourdes, there is a so-called healing spring that people, when they go into the water, they claim that they're healed. What's your take on that?
Well, the young girl who discovered that is another fantasy pro personality. I mean, really, you can look at the, you know, the hallmarks of that personality, the characteristics, the markers, say, you know, has visions, talks to angels. Those sorts of things are associated with fantasy proneness. And there are about a dozen or so of these markers. And if you have, say, seven or more, you might diagnose fantasy proneness. And she would be, Saint Bernadette would be just exactly one of those. People do report healings at Lourdes, but they were for years touted as you know, sort of endorsed by science, because they would say they had this medical bureau at Lourdes, and before they proclaimed a miracle, the doctors there had to examine the claims, and what they did was to say, we can't explain this. We can't explain why Mrs. Smith's cancer went into remission. So the church would say it must be a miracle of the Holy Virgin Mary. The problem is that whole process is logically false. You cannot say, we don't know, therefore, we do know. You can't say the doctors can't explain it, so it's a miracle. This is what's called an argument from ignorance, and it's the paranormal is, of course, just completely you know, based on this, and it's just not a valid way to determine what's so. But in recent years, not too many years ago, the Medical Bureau at Lourdes rebelled, and they knew that what they were doing was not correct, and they sort of quit. They said, yes, we will continue to say that something is, you know, remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay, but this business of jumping from sort of we don't know to this is a miracle, one can see that this is really a misuse of science. This is using science to endorse, in this case, a particular religion and particular claims that are based on nothing more than some doctors say, we never saw anything like it, or it's pretty darn incredible that, you know, went away, or so forth. A skeptic once went to Lourdes, and noticing all the canes and crutches that were stood around, said one of the most clever things I've ever heard. He said, What? No wooden legs? So if someone grew a leg back, that would certainly
be a miracle.
That'd be pretty miraculous, George. Even your friend here who's just, you know, awfully skeptical would have to sputter and do something.
Is there something medicinal in the water?
Not as far as I can as I can tell. I don't think that's really claimed. It's just sort of in the way that in Catholicism, you know, priests prays over a bottle of just ordinary water, and it becomes holy water, becomes imbued with holiness and power. That's sort of the claim. The water itself is you know, spring water and perfectly ordinary. But we do have to look at, there are causes for healings that have to first be looked at. You know, if you have some condition, your own body's healing mechanism may just finally get around to kicking in and taking care of that. Or there may have been, one finds quite often with healing claims, that, oh, yes, well, there was some chemotherapy first, but that didn't seem to be really working, and then a miracle happened. Well, no, maybe the chemotherapy was just took a little while, you see.
Let's move on to the Shroud of Turin, an incredible piece that truly hasn't been authenticated, where a lot of people think that it could be the imprint of Jesus when he was put in the tomb. You think otherwise. What do you think?
That's the claim, and I came on the scene all those years ago, now about half a century ago, really looking into things like that, and the shroud was ultimately something I settled on as a project that really needed to be looked at by serious science-based skepticism, and most of the skeptics were just dismissing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just another silly relic from, you know, the days where they used to fake pieces of the Holy Cross and stuff. And I saw that the shroud was of a different order, that it was something, and it was, you know, it had an image, and it looked more or less realistic and so forth. And I set to work, and I made what little reputation I have today, I think, because of the shroud. I was the guy on the spot with that issue at the right time, published my first book, and became known to skeptics everywhere for that issue, and built on that. And I would just point out that just on the face of it, the shroud is contrary to the gospel account of John, which describes multiple and separate cloths, like a separate cloth over the face, and tying and binding, and a 100-pound weight of the burial spices, myrrh and aloes. Well, right, I could go no further, and we're not talking about the Shroud of Turin, you see, which is a simple, single draped piece of cloth and not a speck of these spices. If we go on, there was no history for the shroud for 1,300 years. Where was it? And the believers now like to come up with so-called theories that, well, maybe it was hidden away, and they try to equate it with the image of Edessa, but the image of Edessa was only a face cloth, and they, you know, they really have to just play games with history. It doesn't show up for, you know, as with real evidence for existing until the middle of the 14th century, at which time a bishop reported to Pope Clement, and his letter can be read, "Holy Father, let me tell you what's going on here in my diocese. This is just, you know, he's why people are being hired to pretend that they're sick, and then they reveal this fake shroud to them, and they pretend they're healed. So that, this is an exact quote, money might be cunningly wrung from the pockets of unsuspecting pilgrims." And he goes on to say that eventually the truth was attested by the artist who painted it.
But doesn't it have a photographic negative look to it?
It does. It does. If you looked at the shroud image and then you looked at a photographic reversal of that, it's the photographic reversal looks more real and lifelike.
Right.
It puts the lights and darks more closely to a realistic looking picture. And so it was said to have photonegative properties and to be miraculous. In fact, the lights and darks have to be looked at with a little more skepticism. In this scenario, the beard and the hair are white. Well, in a 30-year-old Sephardic Jew, he would have had dark hair. So it's the opposite of what you would have expected. Still, the picture looks very good, but it just looks like a white-bearded old man if you look at the reversal, the photographic reversal. So what I found, to make a long story short, is that the lights and darks are exactly what you would get if you did an old-fashioned rubbing. You know how you'd take a rubbing from a gravestone? You put paper over it and you rub
over,
it.
And you rub it over the stone.
You'll get a... It'll hit the high parts will be dark and the other parts will be light. And I showed that you could take a bas relief, that is a low relief that would minimize the distortions, you know, eliminate the wraparound effect and so forth. And I began to make shroud-like effects that were, you know, according to skeptics, just incredibly good. The pro shroud people, you know, despised me and sputtered and claimed mine weren't just quite right and mine were too sharp and stuff. And I would say, well, you know, they're not 600 years old and they're not abraded, but very, very close. The final word on the shroud is really from the fact that it's the McCrone Laboratory found that the image was rendered in tempera, red ochre and vermilion tempera paint, and that radiocarbon dating, which gives a date of 1260 to 1390 range, and multiple labs did this, so it's very well supervised by the British Museum, very accurate, just the time, you see, of the forger's confession. That's a powerful fact. I mean, if you just look at those two facts, we have a report of a forger's confession, middle of the 14th century.
Why do they keep pushing the possibility of authenticity then?
Well, I think they have a sort of three-point plan, as best I can tell. If the shroud were authentic, if it were, let's just say it is for the moment, well, then Jesus was a real person. No mythology there. I mean, let's quit talking about him being some collective figure or some hand-me-down folklore. No, a real guy. And secondly, that he looks just like artists had imagined he looked. Fits the typical, you know, portrayal of Jesus and has the blood stains, the wound in the side, and so forth. So it confirms all that. And number three, if it's inexplicable, and this is a big part of what the pro-shroud people try to do with this photonegativity and other issues, they've tried to say it's basically inexplicable. This is the old argument of ignorance I talked about a while ago, see? We don't know how it was made, therefore it's a miracle. It's the same old illogical bait and switch, and so they're hoping to convince you that it's miraculous because we don't know.
If it's a fake, though, they did a great job with it.
Well, it is really a good workmanlike piece of work. There are a number of mistakes. My book, Inquest on the Shroud of Turin, of course, George has details these mistakes, but they're very good. I mean, the blood is still bright red. There's contradictions in parts of the anatomy, and there are things, the hair, for example. If you look, next time you see a picture of the shroud, notice how it looks like the figure is standing upright and the hair is hanging down on either side of the face as if the figure were standing, whereas if the figure were lying down, the hair would splay out. And there are just lots of things like that. And the blood stains look like they're neatly painted, like little picture-made rivulets painted with a brush. And in fact, real blood, and the famous medical examiner, Dr. Michael Bodden, maybe America's most famous medical examiner, he was on my research team, and he pointed out that real blood would have soaked into the cloth and spangled and run among the fibers. It wouldn't have left little pictures of the blood or imprints of the blood. Dried blood would have left nothing, and the other would have, you know, stuck to the body, soaked into the cloth, and so forth. So once you really go over it with a skeptical eye, it's just miserably mistake prone. But if you start with confirmation bias, in other words, you just believe this is the shroud of our Lord, and then the test is, if you can find a way to make something seem authentic, then you just count it with no more questions. And if it doesn't appear to fit, you just dismiss that on some pretext.
Joe, is there a need?
Explanation.
Is there a need for people? Is there a need for the human mind to have miracles and wondrous things like the Shroud of Turin?
I think so. I mean, I think certainly, if you look back to our ancient ancestors, of course, they didn't understand so much that we do as to what's in the sky and how things worked, and things were just supernatural. I mean, you could see them, someone who they thought was dead would come back to life. Well, my goodness, today we would see how that could be explained. But the need to explain is powerful, and so you make up explanations. Well, they're supernatural beings. They're invisible beings. There's a God, and he's in charge, and they're powerful forces, and those things fill in for we don't know. And I think that's very, very human, but science is a different mode, and if we're voting, I'm going to vote for science because it's powerfully explanatory. It just, the things that can be explained today that were not explainable 100 years, 200 years, the further back you go, the more science looks just utterly remarkable. And dogmas and superstition don't hold up well.
All right, stay with us. Joe, we're going to come back and talk about ghosts and Bigfoot and take phone calls next.